Straight Talk About Vision Loss with Dr. Z.
Welcome to Straight Talk. It's great to have you back again. We've got some very interesting things to talk about today. We're going to be interviewing a mathematician by the name of Dr. Abe Nemeth. Dr. Nemeth has been blind all of his life, and he developed the Nemeth Code, which is a Braille code for math. And we're going to learn about how he did that, as well as just some other interesting things about his life. Dr. Nemeth is 88 years old and still travels and is active within the National Federation of the Blind and doing lots of other things in this country and sometimes even internationally. But before we do that, let me share with you a little bit about yesterday. We had over 100 blind teens in for our annual career fair. It was a fun day of activities. We had speakers and workshops and seminars for the teens. They got to learn about various aspects of getting ready for an interview, how to get a job, how to create some career goals for yourself, as well as we talked a lot about just being a competent blind person and what you need to do in order to achieve your goals. So it was a fun day. I think the kids had a great time, and we sure did. We do this annually. It is a part of our transition program that we do with young blind teens, and we're looking forward to doing it in the future. So I think there's lots of other things that we could talk about that are happening at the Institute, but I really want to spend our time today with Dr. Nemeth. So why don't you join me and have you meet Dr. Abe Nemeth. So here we are with a very interesting fellow that I want you all to know. Many of you know Dr. Nemeth. You may not know him personally, but you certainly know of his work and the Nemeth Code. So today on Straight Talk, we're going to have a conversation with this very interesting academic and learn some about the Nemeth Code, as well as some about Abe's background. So welcome to Straight Talk, Dr. Nemeth. Good to have you here. Can you tell us a little bit about how you ended up becoming a mathematician and going on to advanced graduate school, you know, at the time when you did?
Well, as a child, even when I was in elementary school, I was always interested in math. And I was interested in math, so I took 4 years of math in high school. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, there was a buddy of mine who was one grade behind me. And as I learned elementary algebra in ninth grade, I taught him the same algebra he was in the eighth grade. When he entered high school and they wanted him to take elementary algebra, he protested. He said, "I already know it." Hmm. Okay, so they said, "Well, you have to prove it to us. We have to give you a test." So they gave him a test and he passed the test. Maybe that was the first instance of advanced placement, I don't know.
Now, how did you do all of the equations? Were you at the School for the Blind?
No.
No, you
weren't. I went to the regular New York City public school system.
Wow.
And I hobnobbed with all my sighted peers. I went to the geography class, the spelling class, the arithmetic class. I did not get sequestered in a room with a Braille writer and a computer and a scanner and who knows what else to look like Captain Video.
And this was way before mainstreaming.
Can you tell
us what years this was?
Yes. Uh-huh. Let's see. 1924, 25. You know, I'm 88 years old now.
Wow.
So I was 6 years old in 24. I was born in 1918.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's hearsay. I have to trust my mother to tell me. I have no personal recollection of the event of my birth.
You have a lot of other memories.
Yes. Anyway, this is New York City Public School, mm-hmm. and they had a school equipped or staffed with a resource teacher for the blind in one school in every borough. In Manhattan, my resource teacher was Miss Roberts, and she taught me Braille and she taught me typing. And by 9 years old, I was a competent typist, and she had a globe to teach me geography, mm-hmm. and the oceans were smooth and the land masses were roughed and raised and the mountains were raised even higher. And I remember having a lot of fun running my fingernail through the Panama Canal.
But you were always a curious student. So
yes,
then in high school, you really began to to specialize in math, now, even back then.
I had a Taylor code to use for elementary algebra, and it worked, you know, fairly well. But when I took more advanced math, it mostly didn't work. It was only the same thing is true. You know, low expectations. They gave me enough of a code to get through elementary algebra, but not more than that.
So that's where you began to run into the trouble already.
That's when I began to devise other methods for writing what I wanted. I didn't want superscript letters to be different from superscript numbers, or subscript letters to be different from subscript numbers. I live in a uniform system. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. And when it didn't, I revised. And when I revised, it worked. Another revision worked better, or whatever it is. Little by little, I devised it by a method called trial and accidental success.
And so you started that in high school or in college?
Really, in college.
And where did you go to school?
I went to school, well, my elementary school is public school PS16 in the Bronx. Earlier than that, it was PS110 in Manhattan. But then I moved to the New York Guild for the Jewish Blind, and they were located in Yonkers, New York. But they bused us to school every morning and took us home every night. And it was the New York City public school system that we attended. The school had a resource teacher who was knowledgeable in the skills of blindness. The high school, my teacher was Mr. Meyer Lesowitz. He was the only sight of person I ever knew who could read Braille with his fingers. And he was also a math teacher. And he was the guy who really got me going in math, you know. Because he taught me much more advanced stuff than you could get from a regular high school course, because I could absorb it somehow or other. And he would draw, you know, figures for me in geometry, triangles and circles and chords and all.
Would he do it on swell paper or something?
We didn't have swell paper in 1930. You know? we had regular Braille paper and a cushion with soft backing, like rubber backing, so the spur wheel could dig into the backing and make dots in the paper. And then you had to turn the paper over to read it the right way. Mm-hmm. He drew it with a spur wheel.
That's how you got all the graphics and the figures and all.
But
of
then
that.
I learned to visualize those figures. I didn't need the figure. I could look at the figure. I could construct the figure and read off the important information from the figure in my mind. And that's a very great skill that I could do.
So you've always had kind of that spatial memory function.
Yes, that's right.
What a lot of people would call visual memory, because you could picture it in
your
mind.
That is right. Now, for example, I'll tell you a story. One day I was reclining on my chaise lounge out on my backyard. It was a nice warm summer day. And I was reading a book on Fourier series. I was preparing to teach the course on Fourier series. And in my mind, as I read the Braille, the formulas appeared on a blackboard in print. And I could manipulate the equations and every once in a while check the Braille to see that I got to the right place. And then after a while, my neighbor came over to me and asked me if he could talk to me. I said, sure. And he talked to me for 5 or 10 minutes and left. And I straightened myself out around in my chaise lounge chair. And I looked up at that visual blackboard. The formulas were still there.
So
I could continue to work.
And all in your mind.
All in my mind.
That exercise, you weren't producing any Braille.
Just visualizing. No.
And you were visualizing the print numbers or the Braille dots?
No, the print numbers.
The print numbers.
Now, I'll tell you something.
Okay.
My father, he was quite good. He never had any education. He was just an immigrant. Maybe he went to the third or second grade. I don't know what. But wherever we went, he took me via a different route, because he wanted to inculcate in me a sense of direction. So he would say to me things like, we are now walking west. And when we get to the corner, we will make a left turn. And then we will be walking south. And I learned the compass directions, which is east, which is west, and so on. And he let me touch the raised metal lettering on mailboxes and fire call boxes, police call boxes. He let me touch the raised letterings on license plates, and he let me touch even the neon tubing on the front of door of store windows, so I could
gives cues.
So I could learn how script letters are formed, and he bought me wooden blocks with raised letters and rubber stamps with raised letters, and he made sure I was literate.
Well, and it seems like your dad had kind of an innate ability to instill really what we would call very much discovery method travel methods.
That's right.
And problem solving, you know, and use your
right.
hands, get into the tactile world.
Now,
yeah.
I know that blind people need to know the shapes of the letters. They don't have to become calligraphers, mm-hmm. but they have to know the shapes of the letters. Otherwise, many of the expressions in the English language wouldn't make any sense. If you don't know what a shape of a letter is, you won't know what is a C-clamp, an I-beam, mm-hmm. an O-ring, an S-hook, mm-hmm. a T-square, mm-hmm. a U-turn, mm-hmm. a V-neck, mm-hmm. a Y-connector. All those things, you wouldn't know what they are if you don't know what the shapes of the letters are.
The shapes of the letters, yeah. So, and so, what I find so interesting, you worked with Braille so much with
yes.
your equations, but when you would visualize it, you'd visualize it in the print letters.
My mind is very visual.
Yes.
And I've been blind all my life,
uh-huh.
but my mental, everything in my mind is visual.
It's very visual. So when you're kind of walking around in a room that you haven't been in before, do you tend to kind of
visualize? Uh-huh. I visualize what the room might be like. Mm-hmm. If it's a dining room, I know there's got to be tables, and the tables are aligned in rows, and there are chairs around the tables, and I walk down aisles between the chairs, mm-hmm. you know, back to back.
Yeah.
I may occasionally touch the back of one chair, and I know that I'm walking through an aisle. Pretty soon, I'll find the back of another chair, and so on.
Yeah.
You know, I have a visual image of what that room is like.
That room is like. It's such an example of. So much about what we do in the world is much more about brain function than it is eye function. Can't see, your brain still works and it creates
right.
images. Yeah, very much. But
for most people.
Yeah, for most people. Yeah. You know, some people are not as visual. Some people are more auditory or whatever.
But the point is, many people are not exposed to the infrastructure source. Like, mm-hmm. a lot of kids grow up and they don't know which is east and which is west and north or south.
That's right, because someone just takes them everywhere.
That's right.
Yeah, instead of teaching the kid, okay, which direction are we facing, where are we going,
so that
they have that orientation.
One thing I learned, for example, at high noon, your shadow is pointing due north, at least in the northern hemisphere, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But your shadow is pointing due north at high noon.
Huh, yeah.
And that's a good directional thing if you happen to be out at that particular time.
There's just these various concepts.
Yeah.
So let's go back and talk a little bit about the Nemeth Code, which has become very standardized over the years.
Yeah.
Tell me about the process of it and how it ended up getting adopted as this standard method.
I'll tell you. For a long time, it was a personal code for several years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like some guys would leave their wives one night a week and play pinochle or poker or go bowling or whatever they would do.
Mm-hmm.
My pleasure was going to Brooklyn College and taking a math course. That's what I enjoyed. So that's what I did. And I wanted to turn in the homework, so I developed a way of writing the code to be exactly correct, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked at the American Foundation for the Blind from 44 to 51.
Mm-hmm.
And a colleague of mine there, his name was Dr. Clifford Witcher. He was a blind guy. And he had a degree in physics from Columbia University. And one day he approached me and asked if I had a table of integrals. I said, yes, I have, but it's a private code and you won't be able to read it. He says, well, I'm desperate. Take a few minutes and teach me your private code.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. Now, at that time, the ancestor of today's Braille Authority was called the Joint Uniform Braille Committee. And the word joint referred to the fact that its members were some of them American and some of them British.
Mm-hmm.
And it had subcommittees, and one of the subcommittees was the Mathematics Subcommittee. And Dr. Witcher happened to be a member of the Mathematics Subcommittee.
Ah.
And
was he the first person you taught the method to?
The first person that I showed the code to.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And he brought my code to the attention of the Joint Uniform Rail Committee. And they invited me to write up a short report of how the code works. So I wrote up a report. I regret to say it wasn't as short as they wanted. But I wrote the report, and after they got a hold of it and studied it for a while, they called me to report about it and to answer questions in the Helen Keller Room of the American Foundation for the Blind. And so I went one Friday morning to the Helen Keller Room, and they asked me some questions, and they were evidently pleased with the answers, because after lunch in the afternoon, they voted and the code was adopted.
And it was adopted. And how old were you then?
Well, I was 52. I was 34.
Okay. Were you still in graduate school?
I graduated with a master's degree in psychology from Columbia University. Hmm. And as a blind person, I could not get a job. And my wife knew that I was always taking these math courses. And one day she asked me if I wouldn't rather be an unemployed mathematician than an unemployed psychologist.
Oh, your wife was the one who asked you that question.
Yeah, that was my wife, And that turned the cogwheels in my head. And from that moment on, I considered myself to be a mathematician and not a psychologist.
Not a psychologist, yeah.
And so I kept taking these courses in math. And it was 1946, and the boys were coming home from the army after a war. And they had taken Calculus 1 and had passed it, and were eligible to take Calculus 2. And here they were, registering for Calculus 2. Now you figure out how much Calculus 1 they remembered after a war.
Yeah.
Anyway, we had a help session for them. We had a large room, and the large room was surrounded by blackboards. And each veteran was assigned a panel of the blackboard, and we volunteers, I was one of them, went around helping them. So I would tap a veteran on the shoulder, and I would say, would you read me the problem you're trying to solve from your textbook? And he would read it to me. And I said, well, how far did you get? What did you put on the blackboard? He said, nothing. So I began talking the problem through, and at the proper moment, I picked up the chalk, and I wrote the first formula on the board. And then I did some more talking and wrote the next formula on the board until I got him through the problem.
Yeah.
And I did not know it, but I was being observed by the chairman of the math department. One Friday night, a telegram arrived, and the outside of the telegram delivered by Western Union was of the chairman of the math department, Brooklyn College. I said to my brother, good Lord, what did I do? When we opened the telegram.
You were in trouble.
And
a telegram.
A telegram.
Yeah.
And he said one of his staffers had become ill, would be out for the semester, and would I take his classes. And that's how I got my first teaching job.
And that's how you got your first teaching job.
So I scurried around all weekend. I got the textbook, and my brother read me enough so that I knew what to teach the first Monday night. And that's how I got my first teaching job.
And then you got your first teaching job.
Now, my students were, this was a required course in math they had to take. They were social science majors, but they had to take a required course in math. Mm-hmm. And I did not have control of the syllabus. I was told what topics to cover and how long I should spend on each topic and so on. One of the topics was convergence series, infinite series. And everybody, once in a while in his life, plays around with the series 1 plus a half plus a quarter plus an eighth, plus a sixteenth, and so on. Each number is one half of the previous one, and you add them all up, and the sum gets closer and closer to 2, and the limit is 2, but it never reaches 2 exactly. And I told them all this fancy mathematical jargon. The limit is 2, the series converges. Now I say, you go home and you tell your father all these words, he will be convinced that his money for tuition is being put to good effect.
From the beginning, you've always had an incredible, incredible sense of humor. But then you ended up as a professor at the University of Detroit.
I started my PhD in math at Columbia University. Uh-huh. And when I got my job at U of D, I still did not have my PhD. But I switched my credits to Wayne State University. And I finally got the PhD degree at Wayne State University in Detroit in 1964.
Uh-huh.
That's 43 years ago now.
Yeah.
And, I tell people when they go around the table and ask me to identify myself, I tell them, I got the BA degree in psychology from Columbia and the MA degree in psychology from Columbia University, but at Wayne State is where they gave me the third degree.
Very good. Well, you know, your profession as a mathematician is quite impressive, and to think about the state of blind people back in the 20s and 30s, you know, I think that's what's so interesting about your story. But I remember a conversation we had a while back about what it was like to be a kid in New York City, you know, in around 1920 in those days, and then the Depression, and particularly in the 20s. What was that like?
Well, I don't remember much about the 20s because I was a sub-teen and then.
Yeah.
But I lived through the Depression. In 1931, I was 13.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And the Depression started in 29.
Yeah.
So I was 11. And I lived through the Depression. And when we could afford a bottle of milk, not a carton, but a bottle of milk. We chilled it as when we could under the running tap water in the kitchen, because we couldn't afford the ice.
No ice.
But I never felt deprived. I grew up in an environment of pure love, my parents and my extended family. Mm-hmm. My grandfather was, I guess, the biggest influence in my life. He told me in a million different ways that it's better to light a candle than to curse the dark. Mm-hmm. And he says, don't look for help by telling people that you're blind. Figure out a way to do it yourself. And figure out a way to do it yourself and do it.
So he was pushing you to be independent.
That is right.
You know, right from the beginning. It sounds like you got that message from everyone in your family.
From everyone in my family. Uh-huh. I had an uncle who was a handyman. And he did carpentry work and electricity work and plumbing work. And he was patient with me. He showed me all the things he did. Mm-hmm. Today, if I had to, I could fish an electric wire through the wall and make an outlet. As a matter of fact, when my wife and I had our own home across the street from the university, she bought all the chandeliers and I hung them all up.
And you hung them up.
I hung
because
them up.
Because you were taught at a young age how to
That's
do
right.
these things, and you developed your methods with your hands.
Yeah. We needed a kitchen cabinet. Uh-huh. And either they were too expensive or too flimsy or both. And so I bought the lumber and built the cabinet using power tools, an electric saw, an electric drill, and all these things.
Yeah.
And I built the cabinet.
And you still have all 10 fingers.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell me about your mom sending you to the grocery store.
My mom sent me to the grocery store. You know, she had no qualms about sending me there because I had no streets to cross. I walked to the corner and made a left turn, and three stores on the final block was the grocery store. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a supermarket. It was a hole in the wall.
Yeah. Just a small neighborhood.
And it was operated by my grandfather.
No, your grandfather. Right, right. So that worked pretty good.
Yeah.
But you didn't use a cane when you were younger.
Can
you? Why was that?
I don't know.
Yeah. It just wasn't given to you.
Nobody gave me a cane. I don't think anybody had canes the proper size for my age and height.
Oh, sure.
Nobody had it, you know.
Yeah, canes, it was just for adults.
Canes were for adults, you know.
Yeah.
So, for example, yesterday when I went to the Great Expectations part of the fair, and they were teaching 3 years old to hang clothes on a hook. I said to Bob or Cheadle, how will I reach the hook?
You better have a little stool to stand on for this.
Anyway, I had to bring back the 6 or 7 grocery items that she gave me that I memorized, and the correct quantities, and the correct change, and I did. Mm-hmm. And that's how my memory got trained.
But, you know, the thing that I was so struck with that story is that this was during the Depression. A lot of people didn't have anything. And you're a totally blind kid. But your mother was clearly saying to you, you can do this. You have to do it. I need you to do this.
That's right.
You are an important part of this family. And go do your job.
Well,
you
know? My mother and father were both fun people. Hmm. My mother told me several times that insanity is inherited. You get it from your kids.
Yeah. So, and did you agree with her with that?
Yeah, sure. Because we were a fun family. During the Depression, My father was in business with his brothers as they were partners in the garment industry. And they suffered like everybody else. Mm-hmm. But once in a while, he had a slightly better week. Mm-hmm. And when he had a slightly better week, he would steal his sister's pocketbook and put a $5 bill into it. And she never knew how it got there. She thought it was an oversight that she had overlooked it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She never found out how it got there till 25 years later.
25 years later, yeah. How many children were in your family?
There were three of us. I had a brother and a sister. Uh-huh. They're both gone now.
They're both gone, yeah. Well, I tell you, yesterday, Dr. Nemeth spoke with our teenagers at one of our seminars, and I just wonder what your observations were that. What did you notice about the kids?
Some of them seemed to be motivated and knew how they would handle various job-related functions, mm-hmm. and some of them had no idea.
Yeah.
Some of them had no idea what to do, you know.
Yeah.
Now, when I talked about math, I told them, if you're in elementary school and you have to add up columns of figures, you can't do it on a refreshable Braille display. You have to take a Perkins writer and put the paper in there and line up the numbers one below the other so you can add them or subtract them or multiply them. Mm-hmm. And when you do algebra, you can do the algebra on a refreshable display because you can always read the formula on the previous line and modify it as required. Mm-hmm. But most people don't know what to write down. They don't know the Nemeth code well enough, and the teachers don't know it well enough to teach it. So they try to do math by memory. Mm. There's only so far you can do mm-hmm. math by memory, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the things we're really trying to change with our emphasis on science and technology for these young people and the Youth Slam coming up this summer.
Yeah.
Because so many kids, they don't have the basic skills in order to take the advanced math courses
that, is right.
that prepare them for university.
You have to write it down. You mm-hmm. can't.
Can't all do it on your head, yeah.
Don't do it in your head. You have to write it down.
Yeah. That's right. So, you know, I think we could talk on and on for many hours with you about all kinds of different subjects. But for our viewers, we did do an extensive interview with Dr. Nemeth, and it is on blindscience.org, and you can take a look there. It'll be up shortly, and that'll be a more exhaustive interview with him. But I want to thank you, Dr. Nemeth, for being here and sharing some of your thoughts.
You're very welcome.
Yeah. It was fun to talk with you and reminisce.
I enjoyed reminiscing.
Yeah. Well, we'll do it again. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and we'll see you next time for Straight Talk.
www.nfb.org, 410-659-9314.